second hour of Issues Etc., a rare opportunity, although I was thinking during the break here, it's not as rare as I first thought. Craig and I have actually sat together. I believe it was up in Trago, Wisconsin, a couple of years back. We weren't here in Studio A, but it was a live hour of Issues Etc. with Craig. We're going to be talking about, well, we're going to be talking about the legal case for Christianity. There's far more to it than that sounds like, but you want to stay tuned. The best callers and emailers during this hour of the program will get a copy of Craig's book, The Defense Never Rests. Craig Parton is an attorney in Santa Barbara, California, and you can join our conversation as we talk about Christianity, apologetics, and evangelism. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Before we get started with Craig, in the third hour of the program, we've got a lot of audio to get through. Recently, this was last week, Rick Warren, author of The Purpose-Driven Life and pastor of Saddleback Church in Lake Forest, California, I always get these names mixed up, was on Larry King Live. He was brought on because his book played a pivotal role in a hostage situation involving the gunman Nichols. You'll remember the story from the news. Well, that's what they talked about initially, but there are several other subjects that were broached during that conversation between Larry King and Rick Warren. This was his first major public media appearance, and we will bring some of the audio from that to you in the third hour during open lines for your questions and your comments. Those numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Craig Parton is the United States Director of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights in Strasbourg, France, and he's author of this book, The Defense Never Rests, A Lawyer's Quest for the Gospel. Craig, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Todd, thank you. It's a pleasure to be back here.
How are your travels out from the West Coast?
A little rocky, a little bumpy getting in.
Really?
So, yeah.
On a beautiful day like this?
Beautiful day in St. Louis. Who'd have thought?
Is this roughly akin to California weather?
It is. 75 degrees. Getting a little muggy, I have to say.
Okay. That's definitely a non-St. Louis resident calling this muggy.
We went back to the beach.
All right. We're going to be talking about apologetics. And we're going to be talking about making the case for Christianity. You're going to be doing that at an appearance that we'll discuss here a little bit later in our conversation. Let's make a fundamental distinction, but not drive a wedge too far between apologetics, the task of apologetics, and the task of evangelism. Define those both. Make the distinction and the connection between those two, if you would.
Apologetics is simply giving a reason for the hope that is within you. It's the First Peter admonition, 1 Peter 3:15, to be ready always to give a reason, to defend when asked questions about the Christian faith, to be able to give a response to that. So if somebody asks you about the problem of evil, you're prepared to give a response. Somebody asks you about the reliability of the New Testament, you're prepared to give a response. For a variety of issues that come up today, it may be how can you believe in the God of Christianity in light of the evil in the universe, but it can be everything in between. Apologetics seeks to start where the unbeliever is and answer their question, using it as an opportunity to go to the cross. Now, evangelism, at least technically, and let's take the narrowest definition, is presenting the 1 Corinthians 15 gospel to a person, calling a person to belief. It is telling them about Jesus, his death, perfect life, and resurrection from the dead, their need to come to grips with that. That is a narrow definition. What often happens is people draw, I think, an improper distinction between apologetics bring a wedge between the two, between apologetics and evangelism, seeing apologetics as something done for the intellect, something done that's outside of the case for Christianity, is just foundational, preliminary, where evangelism is really the thing that people ought to be interested in. Actually, these aren't clean and tight categories at all. When you're presenting the evidence for Jesus Christ being God in the flesh and rising again from the dead, you are at the heart of the gospel. There isn't any effective distinction between apologetics and evangelism at that point. You're marshaling the evidence for Christian belief. And so it's important that we not think that apologists somehow are doing intellectual headwork that has nothing to do with bringing people to the cross of Christ. And so often we get that impression. The guys doing apologetics are the most irrelevant to the church. They're somewhere, you know, way down the list there. First, you have missionaries as the highest level, pastors, called church workers, and way down there in the primordial soup is the apologist who's involved with irrelevancies. Should not be the case.
Now, one concern that you need to answer before we move on, the person who's just heard that distinction but that connection between apologetics and evangelism might say, look, apologetics operates in the realm of reason, and there's nothing wrong with reason when you're making a case for history, but you can't reason people into the faith. Mm-hmm. Evangelism operates in the realm of faith, and the twain never shall meet. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to someone who says, you're talking about reasoning people to the faith, and that you just can't do?
Very important distinction needs to be made here between giving people the impression that human reason saves them, which Luther called one of the ladders of ascent, which is absolutely unbiblical, to give people the impression that somehow through either moral acts, rational or intuition, rational efforts, they can save themselves. Very different than using, as Montgomery says, the appendage that's growing above your neck, called your head, which God has given you. The fact is in Scripture, even after the fall, man is still able to understand facts. I also believe he's able to understand and interpret facts correctly. That doesn't mean he can save himself. But we need to be careful when we talk about the role of reason in the Christian proclamation, because our faith is faith in something. It's not faith in faith. It's faith in a person of Jesus Christ, and content to that faith, which is his perfect life, atoning death for the sins of the world, and his resurrection. So there is content to that that is apprehended by the human mind. Conversion is of the whole person, body or soul, spirit, body, of course, you're completely converted. But the fact of the matter is, when people try to indicate that you shouldn't use reason to talk to people about the Christian faith, you've got to employ reason to have a conversation with someone. You wouldn't know that you're having a conversation with a person versus a kumquat unless you used reason. We use it every day. We employ it every day. We use it to discover secular facts. We use that same reason to discover spiritual facts. What we're not saying is that simply using your reason saves you. Coming to an intellectual understanding of facts saves you. That is not the biblical picture. Only the Holy Spirit using that preached gospel and using that clear case for Jesus Christ brings conversion to the individual.
So you were talking about 1 Corinthians 15. Paul says, I want to remind you again the terms in which I preach the gospel and what it has been from the very beginning, and I haven't changed it one bit. And that is, and then he talks about Jesus Christ was made a sacrifice for sins. On the third day he was raised again from the dead according to Scripture, and he is making a case for events that took place. Jesus actually came out of that grave alive. He was seen by a handful of people and then a whole big bunch of people, and many of them are still alive today. Go check it out if you feel the need.
Absolutely. He's calling people to investigate this case. It doesn't happen in a corner. And the problem we get into as Christians when we give non-Christians the impression that they have to have special spiritual goggles to understand the case for Christianity is that many of them will look at us and say, well, you know, frankly, I'm just not a very religious person. And if you have to be spiritual to understand this, in other words, already have a commitment to this stuff being true before you can investigate it, I really am not interested. I don't see that as being the apostolic pattern at all. You look at Paul operate in the book of Acts. He is out there on the street corner presenting this as if it has not happened in a corner. You can check it out yourself, and this material, this case, will drive you in a direction. That direction is an affirmation of who Jesus Christ is. Now, certainly anybody becomes a Christian as a result. The apologist, the evangelist, can take absolutely no credit for this whatsoever. It's all to the glory of God alone. But the fact of the matter is God uses weak vessels like us to preach that clear message to people and to call people to belief. I think we do a great, great disservice in Christianity today by avoiding and ignoring apologetics and giving people, unbelievers, the impression it's really a matter of sentiment. You either grew up and you're oriented this way, or you have some particular emotional need for it, or you don't. And I think we've really reinforced that if you look at most of what Christianity does in terms of its public proclamation to unbelievers.
Has the apologetics task become more important now in the age of religious pluralism and relativism?
I think it is as important today as in the first century. And tragically, there are perhaps fewer people involved in the apologetical task today than ever in the church's history. And why this is the case, there's a lot of historical reasons for that. But in an age of pluralism, it absolutely is incumbent on us to distinguish ourselves and the Christian proclamation from other religious positions that are out there. And tragically, what's going on in so much of Christianity and liberal Christianity for decades, but even in mainline Christianity, is this effort to find what's true in all religions, instead of, as a fundamental point, realizing there is a fundamental disconnect between all the world's religions. And whether that be in their philosophy of the human being, the nature of human sin, the nature of salvation, where history is going, the basis for authority, all the world's religions and critical worldviews differ fundamentally. And unless we're prepared in the apologetical realm to deal with that, to first explain that there is a fundamental disconnect, maybe all world religions are wrong, but they can't all be right, and then marshaling the case for the uniqueness of Christianity as a result of that, all we do is throw Christianity into the religious mix of the day, and we end up saying, you really should try it because it'll make your lifestyle better.
But isn't that what most unbelievers, non-Christians, especially in the Western world, believe about Christianity? It is one subjective choice among many subjective choices, and they put Christianity on the same level with Islam and Judaism and Hinduism and Buddhism and all the other isms.
Precisely. And why do they do this? Because they've heard people on Christian radio, they've watched Christian television, they've heard Christians talking about why they're Christians, and what do they hear? So oftentimes what they hear is, you ought to become a Christian because you'll get peace of mind. It did this and that for me. We have a nicer family life. My prayer life is better. I understand how the world connects. Well, believe it or not, there's a lot of non-Christians that are really happy people. This is a shock to non-Christians or to other Christians. Oh, no, they can't be. No, I know many of them. I practice law with a number of them. They really are happy, and they think that life goes along just fine. The fundamental distinction with Christianity is it claims to be true whether they ever come to grips with it or not. It makes fundamental truth claims to them.
And to tell you the truth, it seems also false advertising that to say become a Christian and your life will markedly improve personally, financially, your marriage, your parenting, your relationship at work, all of these things will improve markedly. That's not necessarily a promise that Orthodox Christianity can keep.
No. And Christianity does not claim to link up all the dots in the universe. Frankly, it leaves a lot of things in little gullies where it's, you know, we don't know what the answer to that problem is, the final answer to that. And it leaves a lot of those kinds of things unanswered. So if somebody thinks they're going to get the final definitive answer to every question of the universe as they become a Christian, they'll be sorely disappointed.
We're talking about the legal case for Christianity and Christianity's truth claims. Craig Parton is our guest. He's an attorney in Santa Barbara, California, United States Director of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights in Strasbourg, France, and author of the book, The Defense Never Rests, A Lawyer's Quest for the Gospel. The best callers and emailers will receive a free copy of that book, 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, we get it right here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. issuesetc@kfuo.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc., and we're coming to you live this Tuesday. It's the 29th of March. Okay, you are going to be presenting here in St. Louis to a probably largely mixed group, but I would say a fair number of just secularists. We might even use the term pagans. You're going to be marshaling the case for Christianity. In a nutshell, what are you going to say?
Well, we're first going to talk about the fact that most of the world's religions really don't make truth claims that can be checked out. We will discuss the fact of how lawyers have been attracted historically to Christianity and why that has been. And the reason is that Christianity makes claims that lawyers know beg to be checked out. These writers beg to be impeached on a witness stand. They're the kind of thing a trial lawyer's dream. Somebody like Luke, with all that detail in their writings, it begs to be examined. If this guy isn't being accurate, he will be torn to pieces by a decent trial lawyer. So we're first going to talk about setting up why lawyers have been attracted to religious truth claims in general, why there's so few religious truth claims out there to be checked out, and in fact, really the only religious position that meets objective truth claims that can be verified or falsified ends up being Christianity. Not Islam, not Judaism, not the Eastern New Age religions, but Christianity. And so we're going to shift our attention this evening to look at the case for Christianity. And just because we're looking at Christianity doesn't mean that we presume that it's true, but we're going to investigate its claims. And we're going to look at those claims as to in a couple of areas. First, how good is the written record in which those claims are contained? I'm not talking about the Bible. I'm not talking about a black leather covered 66 book presentation. We're going to be looking at only the eyewitness accounts, the close associates of eyewitness accounts of the life of Jesus Christ, the claims made there with respect to his perfect life and death on the cross and resurrection. How good are the documents that case is, or that story is given to us? How do lawyers look at it? How would somebody from a completely outside of religious context analyze Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Then we're going to look at the actual testimony that is in those records, if they are reliable, investigate them in terms of what the internal and external evidence is for the reliability of those actual writers. We'll turn and investigate from a lawyer's perspective the resurrection. We'll ask questions that have been asked for some time by secularists, by people outside of the Christian faith. Why even spend the time looking at the resurrection when it's not possible to have occurred anyway? The idea that miracles are not possible. We'll look at that issue. And then finally, after all of that is done, somebody from the outside may say, look, okay, you looked at Christianity because it makes objective claims. And you've presented a case for the reliability of the New Testament documents, the testimony that's contained in those documents, the resurrection. But you know, it all comes down to a matter of interpretation anyway. And there's as many interpretations of the Bible as there are Christian sects out there. And so thank you very much, but no thanks. We're going to look at that issue also tonight. And I think the law provides a very interesting perspective as to how to go about interpreting these documents, because lawyers, amazingly enough, have spent a lot of time looking at how to interpret documents and what kind of principles of hermeneutics, called in theology, but its interpretation, have been developed in the law to interpret a document, and how can those be applied to what we see in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Is it really just a matter of how you look at it? Can it be made to say anything you want to have said by it? Is that really the case for it? And we'll investigate that.
Okay, let's go to the phones and take a few calls here before this break. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll get to each one of those points in due course that Craig has just mentioned. James is up first. He's calling from South St. Louis. James, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Your guest? Where's he going to be tonight?
He's going to be at, tonight he is going to be at Wohl Hall in, Washington University here in St. Louis from 7 until 9 o'clock.
Okay. Well, the reason why I say that is because a lot of the questions that I've been wrestling with for, it seems like, years, he's either answered or he's talked about or he's going to talk about tonight or something. You know.
Well, you definitely want to attend tonight. This is something that you, I mean, just any chance to hear Craig talk is a rare opportunity. Do you have a question or a comment, James?
Well, that was my comment. Well, Holly, I'm just amazed that they have you here. Well, I'm not amazed about your show, but I mean, I think the Lord has answered my quest by listening to your show tonight.
James, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Do you hear this very often? I mean, what you're going to do tonight, you have done many times in front of hostile groups, people who have no interest or a disinterest in Christianity. Do you hear this?
Well, I hear people saying, it's not unusual to have people say, I have never heard of Christianity being investigated objectively. I didn't understand that this was a case that could be made factually, that stood the rigors of cross-examination, that would stand up in any court of law, and in fact has been cross-examined in a court of law for 300 years by trial lawyers, which we'll talk about tonight. And trial lawyers, you can say a lot about them. One thing that you probably don't say about them is that they're naturally religious people, or that they seem to be, the best Christians around. And so I find a lot of people finding it very interesting that people legally trained, evidentially trained, and trained in courtroom advocacy have been very attracted to Christianity because of its claims to be checked out and to look at it that way. And you know, maybe James is getting at is the fact that there's so much that you can hear out today when there's zillions of Christian broadcasts and other things that are floating around on the airwaves today, but very few programs talk about the objective case, the factual underpinnings of the Christian faith. They're so often on assuming that you already believe it and then asking you to apply certain biblical teachings instead of going back to some foundational things that the apostles did and really talking about, did these things occur or not? The foundational questions, which get avoided a lot in Christian circles.
Okay, so it's going to be 7 o'clock tonight at Wohl Center at Washington University here in St. Louis. Is everybody invited, Craig?
Yes.
Everybody.
You're looking at me like
yeah,
this.
Yeah, well, you're the one who's actually going to be speaking.
Oh, absolutely. And my background is in campus work in classrooms and debates and those kinds of settings. So I really welcome people with questions, people who don't want to be in a situation where they feel like the doors are going to be locked and an offering plate handed out. That's the not the modus operandi here. It's to come together to look at religious claims in general, see how they stand up, and then particularly take our sights on the case for Christianity and simply look at this. My goal is that people would leave and say, there's some things that I want to look into further. And now I feel like I know where I can go to look into those items, those issues on a further depth basis.
We're talking with Craig Parton live here in Studio A, A Legal Case for Christianity. James, by the way, the first caller, call back, and I'm going to send you a copy of Craig's book, The Defense Never Rests, A Lawyer's Quest for the Gospel. When we come back from this break, we're going to walk through some of these points and take your phone calls one by one. What about the written record, the documentary evidence, its testimony, the event of the resurrection, and is it all just a matter of interpretation? We'll be right back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What elements does a sermon need to be considered a law-gospel sermon? What did the Apostle Paul mean when he told the Corinthians, "We preach Christ crucified"? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for March is titled Selected Sermons of Norman Nagel. You can read sermons preached by one of our most popular guests, Dr. Norman Nagel of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Visit our website, issuesetc.org, for more information on Selected Sermons of Norman Nagel. Or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Selected Sermons of Norman Nagel cost $24.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040. Jesus, Jesus, and More Jesus in Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March. Selected Sermons of Norman Nagel. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. Fans of our Sermon Evaluation Series will appreciate Selected Sermons of Norman Nagel, Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Whether over the dinner table, at the water cooler, or in the bleachers, people all over America are talking about Terri Schiavo and the value of life. Stuart Shepherd reports on the long-term impact of the public debate.
It's a case that saturated the nation's airwaves.
CNN headline news.
Terri Schiavo.
Terri Schiavo.
Terri Schiavo.
Terri Schiavo.
Terri Schiavo.
It's on every news station. It's what everybody is talking about. It's on every radio station. And I think young people are right in the middle of it.
26-year-old Amber Dolly with Rock for Life describes people her age as the post-Roe v. Wade generation. It's all they've ever known. But the intense media focus on the Schiavo case is driving new conversations.
Young people are really starting to see, hey, if they can do this to her, who's to say they can't do it to me or to my mom or my sister or my dad?
She says, in a sense, this is her generation's Roe v. Wade, a societal event that's compelled young people to engage in deep, life-changing discussion.
Well, I think that's it. It is a dramatic case, and I'm hopeful that all lives have a purpose, and Terri Schiavo's purpose will be to wake up a lot of people.
Phyllis Schlafly with Eagle Forum is a veteran of the debate over life. She says in the coming weeks we'll learn more of the full impact, but one thing's for sure.
I think it's going to impact the issue of the judges even more than the pro-life issue. It is showing people that the judges are anti-life all the way up and down the line.
Schlafly expects to see stronger support for life issues, particularly among evangelicals, but also in the population at large. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepherd.
There's also a new interest in end-of-life documents, such as those designating someone with durable power of attorney. The Christian Medical Association is offering at no cost a guide to end-of-life health care that includes an advance directive form for patients and their families. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers. We'll talk with David Burrow, an award-winning writer and producer of television documentaries, commercials, and specials. He's also been an elder in his Presbyterian church. He's the author of Why Men Hate Going to Church. It begins at 11:05, Living Jubilee, on AM 850 KFUO.
Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March features sermons preached by Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Norman Nagel and is titled Selected Sermons of Norman Nagel. It's published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about Selected Sermons of Norman Nagel on our website, issuesetc.org. Selected Sermons of Norman Nagel, Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Halfway through the program today and halfway through a conversation with Craig Parton, A Legal Case for Christianity. He's an attorney in Santa Barbara, California, United States Director of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights in Strasbourg, France, and author of the book The Defense Never Rests, A Lawyer's Quest for the Gospel. The best callers and emailers are getting a copy of that book, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. To the phones again, Sam calls from his car. Sam, thank you for being patient, and welcome to Issues Etc.
Well, thanks. As you guys were having your conversation, it occurred to me that part of the problem, I would think, with the fact that Christians aren't into apologetics is the way the evangelical views faith as something that you just kind of take a flying leap off of a cliff, and that you don't really have any real substance to your faith. You just do it because that's what you're supposed to do. Our church I was in once was using a well-known evangelical method of evangelism, and one of the things you're told as you go through this method of evangelism with a person is when they start asking questions, you basically get them back on the right track because those are just distractions.
Hmm. Interesting.
And so we kind of grow up thinking, you know, we think that way. Oh, that's not a real issue. They're just a distraction.
All right, Sam, thank you very much. You seem familiar with that particular quote-unquote form of evangelism.
I really understand what you're saying there, Sam, and that's one of the, you know, I hate to criticize groups that are using things like the four spiritual laws that at least are getting out there trying to evangelize people. I applaud that. Believe me, if we had more people caring enough about evangelism and their problem was they were stuck with a rote little presentation that they couldn't alter, that would be a nice problem to have. But you have struck on something, is that when you do have that kind of memorized program that you have to get through, any deviation from this is courting disaster. And, you know, I try to encourage people to read widely in apologetics in all kinds of areas that would be of interest. Why? Because apologetics is starting where the unbeliever is. I mean, what you're talking about, situation you have, and you mentioned a prior church experience, that all works great when the key is we get to say what we want to say when we want to say it. And that's, I think, is a faulty, unbiblical way of going about it. It's first finding out who your audience is, what their unique problems may be, and bringing the cross of Christ into that situation, understanding what the objections of the unbeliever are, and maybe being willing to say, you know, that is a very, very good question. And, you know, frankly, I don't know the answer to that. That shocks unbelievers, a humility that says, you know, that's good. I suspect there's an answer to that. I suspect you're not the first person who's asked that question. And I think I know where I might be able to find an answer that may be satisfactory to you. And I'd like the opportunity to do that. I have done that with people. Instead of giving them this line that, you know, what you're showing is you're really not staying on my points. You know, that kind of approach to preaching the gospel to people is counterproductive. Now, the other side of it is, of course, sometimes non-Christians just want to divert you from really getting to the heart of the case for Christianity, which, I mean, essentially reduced is, who do you say I am, as Jesus turned to the apostles? Who do you say that I am? That is the question we want to get to with them, and not letting non-Christians weasel around that continually with questions that don't seem to be serious questions, and that when you answer them, they've just got another one. It's like they had a whole list of them they didn't really care about. So I very much understand what you're saying.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Herman calls from Illinois. Herman, welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. I would say that one comment right off before I get to my other is we're in an emergency condition in this country for good, solid apologetics. I can think of there are sadly a number of denominational seminaries, divinity schools that are sleepwalking deeply in liberal fog. And I wanted to ask Greg Parton, when he deals with the evidence, say, within Scripture precisely for Christ's resurrection, how would he evaluate the stature and support of, like, Josephus, Suetonius, Tacitus, Pliny, and even the Talmudic sources that record the Sanhedrin's warrant against and charges against Jesus?
Herman, thank you very much.
Excellent question, Herman. The fact is a number of very effective apologists have presented the case for the historicity of Jesus Christ and the fact that the early Christian community worshipped him as God from these early non-Christian sources. Gary Habermas has a book, Ancient Evidence for the Life of Jesus. Lord Cairns has one. I have a footnote to it in The Defense Never Rests. It's been done. I think that evidence is very worthwhile to make it absolutely clear that this man, the historicity of Jesus, can be established even without the eyewitness accounts. And it can be done.
Now, the events of the gospel will not necessarily be established.
Exactly.
There.
The events of the gospel may be problematic, but you will have, for example, Pliny the Younger, I think in 112 A.D., has his letters saying Christians meet once a week to sing hymns to Jesus as God. Not a bad little confirmation that early Christianity had it very clear that Jesus Christ claims were to be God in the flesh. So that material is useful to establish the historicity of Jesus. Habermas uses 39 ancient non-biblical sources, the kind that Herman mentioned, to establish 110 facts about the life of Jesus suffered under Pontius Pilate. I could go on and on. Outside of the biblical account. That's all positive. It can be done. It's very effective. I don't personally rely on that when presenting the case for Christianity, because in a court of law, those witnesses would never be allowed to testify. Why? They're not primary source material. They are not eyewitnesses of the events or operating within a circle where they can verify this with eyewitnesses of the events. So they are technically, and the law calls them, hearsay sources. So when I deal with legally oriented audiences, I certainly can bring this material up as supportive, but the primary source, the stuff that gets in that's admissible at trial, is the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John material. Why? Because they saw this with their own eyes, or in the case of there may be a case where they were able to check this out directly through Peter, Mark through Peter kind of thing. So while we can use that material, be very careful that you don't fall into a situation where you think that the New Testament Gospels are somehow secondary or not as effective in presenting the case for Christianity, because as Todd said, they actually get you the gospel in them.
All right. Let's walk through these very quickly in kind of rapid-fire succession. I'm asking a lot of a lawyer to be brief, but we'll do it.
Yes.
I want to get through these 4 points.
Really hurts because we bill by the increments of an hour.
And I'm not paying you. So. The written record, the documentary evidence, make the case for how strong or weak it is in the case of those eyewitness documents.
It's phenomenally strong, and this has been done not just by me. It was done long before I wrote my book. I mean, it's been done for hundreds of years by people particularly who are trained in classics and in understanding how works of antiquity get down to us. And the fact of the matter is, the sources I use to establish the authenticity, that is, that the New Testament Gospels come very early on top of the events that they record, and they come with sufficient copies that we have tremendous confidence that what we are reading today accurately reflects the original as it was written in the first century. That case has been made by non-Christians, or at least I should say by people operating in fields that have nothing to do with Christian theology. People like A.N. Sherwin White at Oxford, people like F.F. Bruce is teaches at the University of Manchester, at least did. We have Kenyon at British Museum, classic scholars that I'll cite tonight. In other areas, who will make the case that the New Testament works are the best attested works of all of antiquity. And actually, Todd, the fascinating thing to me is I've done this in different places across the country, from Ivy League to Stanford, Berkeley, and all in between. I've never had a classics professor ever take me on this. I've had religious studies professors say, no, our material is very unreliable, but never a classics professor, who always have the utmost respect for how good of a manuscript tradition we have.
Within those documents, the actual testimony, as you would refer to it, in a, that's found in those documents, how strong is this?
Again, there's very developed tests in the law as to how you determine if a witness is telling the truth or not. And there's a couple of tests that you do. One is called the internal consistency test, which is what kind of personalities, character do these people have? In the case of the New Testament witnesses, you have people who attested to this, the truth of their writings with their own lives, which is not a bad way to test this out. So you have internally, you have phenomenally strong testimony for this. There is not an iota of evidence that these people made money off of this position at all. This material comes early, contra the Da Vinci Code. It comes early. It comes from people who paid with it by their own lives and who had no economic, in fact, probably every economic incentive to go the other direction, but the facticity of it drew them to record it the way it is recorded, which it rings with authenticity.
Now, before you go on, this whole attesting to it by their lives, one might counter, and I'd like your response, that there have been many a charlatan.
That's true.
Who have gone to their graves not only believing but holding fast to something that was patently false. Jim Jones, Heaven's Gate, you can name others, where people have sincerely believed it, sadly paid with their lives in the name of their belief.
Right.
And they were wrong.
Right. And it is important to point out that isn't the only factor that shows you that these people are giving us the straight story. But if people are claiming that Jesus really did not rise from the dead and that the disciples were aware of this but wanted to go out and tell this story anyway, you have a real hard time getting to that from the documents themselves. These people present it. They pay for what they at least believe was the truth. Now, you could argue they were deceived. That's a different argument. But you certainly have to conclude, I think, from any reasonable reading in the New Testament, these people really believed this was true. It wasn't like they were making it up. They believed this body was gone, that they had personally seen this man risen from the dead and paid for it with their own lives. But that's not the only basis for determining the reliability of a witness. The other is checking it out with other external evidence, archaeological evidence. Do other external sources support the writings, the things that are being said by the New Testament writers? And again, archaeology has been a tremendous friend for Christian truth claims and the external evidence that you see there. There's other lines of evidence we'll talk about tonight on the external level that we can marshal, but the sum total of it is that these people had every reason to get this right. Why? Because it circulated amongst hostile witnesses who had every motivation to impeach them. The Romans, the Jewish religious authorities, had motivation, means, and opportunity to get out and find the body or to refute that this is what Jesus had said. They had every motivation to do it, and you don't find that refutation occurring. And I think that's another strand of very powerful evidence that lawyers, at least, have been very attracted to.
Craig Parton is our guest, A Legal Case for Christianity, during the second hour of the program today. He's an attorney in Santa Barbara, California, United States Director of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights in Strasbourg, France, and author of this book, The Defense Never Rests, A Lawyer's Quest for the Gospel. Now, there are two events that I want you to be aware of. The first one, Craig, is referred to. That's tonight at Wall Hall, in the northwest corner of Wall Hall. There's a dining room there at Washington University here in St. Louis from 7 until 9. Craig will be presenting a trial lawyer's cross-examination of religious truth claims. Can any religious truth claims be verified? And what about Christianity? And then tomorrow, from 10:45 until 12:15 in the morning, that's tomorrow, here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Werner Auditorium, just ask any one of these young seminarians that you might bump into where Werner Auditorium is, and they will point you in the right direction. From 10:45 until 12:15 in the morning, he'll be presenting this convocation, presenting the case for Christianity to the skeptic, a trial lawyer's perspective. That's tonight from 7 to 9 p.m. at Wall Hall at Washington University here in St. Louis, and tomorrow from 10:45 to 12:15 at Werner Auditorium at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. You can meet Craig Parton tonight or tomorrow at either of those events. And I think I'm going to be at the one tomorrow morning. Tonight is a little more difficult to manage, but I will be there because I do not want to miss an opportunity to hear Craig make this presentation. All of our Issues Etc. listeners are encouraged to attend. The entire public is invited. All right. We've talked about the documentary evidence, the witnesses themselves whose testimony is found in this documentary evidence. What about the event of the resurrection itself? How does it stand up in terms of the evidence?
Well, interestingly enough, in a court of law, the fact that an event is unique and unrepeatable does not mean it's dismissed. Lawyers and courts of law and judges will not say to a jury, now you're going to hear an event that you've never heard about before. And you know, because of that, you should disbelieve it. The fact is, when you go into a court of law, evidence is established for an event taking place. And there are very, very few assumptions that people are allowed to make about how the universe operates in a court of law. And if you can establish that an event happened, even if it quote, violates what you think is a law of nature, you go with the facts over your presuppositions of how you think the world should operate.
So the fact that no one else has been witnessed being raised from the dead in the manner of Jesus Christ does not immediately preclude it as something that can have evidence in its favor.
That exactly right. The question is, how good is the evidence? Now, admittedly, the general rule is people live and then they die and then they stay dead. And if that wasn't the case, I imagine we would have been burying a lot of the wrong people. So in this situation, that is, we don't deny that is the general rule. But it is with a very important exception, and it's based on where the evidence leads. And frankly, this is the most scientific approach to dealing with the universe. It doesn't allow us to sit back like David Hume in the 18th century and not investigate whether indeed events occurred or not, because we somehow have a pipeline to the center of the universe that says we know that miracles can't occur. There's more humility in the law about that. And so lawyers have recognized that Christianity hinges on this one event. If this event did not take place, as our pastor said on Sunday, everything is a waste of time that you did in this church this year. Okay? You should have been out eating and drinking and being merry. Instead, you were here, you were listening to us, the preaching here and taking the sacraments. He said, you've wasted your time. And lawyers have recognized that if they could bring down the resurrection, they would destroy Christianity on the basis of the documents' claims themselves. They beg to be checked out on that. So lawyers have very rigorously applied the laws of evidence to the resurrection and concluded that the evidence was overwhelming, that this man died on the cross. And tonight I'll bring together some of that objective, that evidence from the medical side that has been done very carefully on whether Jesus Christ indeed died on the cross. It's absolutely unimpeachable material. And then secondly, that he was seen again by others alive. And the conclusion of the church and of the written material of the eyewitnesses is they call this a resurrection. I don't care if you call it banana split. The question is not the name that you put over it. It's the fact that it occurred. We call it a resurrection. A man was dead and now is alive. Now, that's not the whole case there, because there are other people who claim to have died and come back again from the dead. In Jesus Christ's case, he said this was going to be the attestation that I am God in the flesh and have the authority to forgive the sins of man. This is what I'll do, because Jesus himself raised Lazarus from the dead during Jesus' lifetime. And Lazarus, no, people don't walk around worshiping him. Only with Jesus do you get this unique combination of the predictions that his birth would come, that he would be the Messiah. Secondly, that he actually accomplished this on Calvary's cross, that it fulfilled his words that he would indeed die in atoning death for the sins of the world, and that his resurrection would verify or put the stamp of approval that he is indeed God's Son and the Savior of the world. So Jesus gives you himself the best interpretation of how to understand the resurrection, because ultimately you have two sources to understand the resurrection. You have people who didn't rise from the dead, or you have Jesus. And as a trial lawyer, I would prefer... I wouldn't say prefer, I'd say demand, that I would rather hear from Jesus and what he believes the resurrection means rather than anybody else's comment.
Two very quick final questions. The first one comes from Carl. He writes this via email. It seems that people who advocate for the use of apologetics seek and fight for an immediate response to their argument. Sadly, we have lost the art of friendly debate. Just because we disagree, it does not mean that we have to dislike each other. How can the use of apologetics be separated from this desire for instant gratification? Very briefly, with less than a minute here.
Carl is on to something. We're very bad in just conversation with non-Christians. and it is an art. And it is not something that Christians are very comfortable doing. Having a discussion that may be open-ended, leave some things unresolved. It's a matter of being friendly. It's a matter of being sociable. And it truly is a developed art. And, you know, more power to you, Carl, if you're able to develop that. On the other hand, may I just provide a word of caution? Tonight may be a person's last night. If that is the case, I always take very seriously about the issue of pressing this to the point of asking a person to believe and be saved. I think it's appropriate. I understand what Carl's saying, that this can be pushy, asking for, you know, an immediate response, but I also don't know where that person may be after they leave my presence. And I think it's appropriate, and I think if I understand the apostolic position on this, they were more than willing to make sure people understood that it was important to come to grips with Jesus Christ now.
So in other words, not just an intellectual exercise. A final question with only a minute to respond. You said the last point is the objection that it's all a matter of interpretation. Maybe you've got a reliable document, witnesses, and an event of the resurrection, but there's so many varied sects among Christianity, and it's all really a matter of individual interpretation. With 1 minute, how do you respond?
The law doesn't look at documents that way. I try cases all the time. It's how I make a living, and many of them are based on documents and how documents are to be understood. I just had a trial that related to how to understand a document that was over 75 years old. There's one proper interpretation, and the court will instruct that there is one proper way to understand this document. And there isn't, it's not up to everybody's individual way of looking at things. And the law has developed very, very concise rules on how to understand these. I'll go through these this evening. The fact of the matter is, though, Todd, we don't even live that way. We don't live like everything is a matter of everyone else's interpretation. We don't go to doctors. We don't go to radiologists to have cancer scans read who have the view that it's all a matter of interpretation. You know, I think you have cancer, but then again, it may be a sausage that's in you. The world doesn't work like that. As a matter of fact, this kind of it's all a matter of interpretation is kind of a nice intellectual exercise, but it's not a reflection of how life and death decisions are made in the real world.
Craig Parton is an attorney in Santa Barbara, California, United States Director of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights in Strasbourg, France. I understand, Craig, before I let you go, that there are a few openings for this summer's academy. There are a few that pulled out, and that leaves some openings here.
We did. We had a couple of people from Canada who were going to have to postpone coming to the next year, and so we do have, I believe, two openings, which just occurred. So we'd love to have anybody join us this summer in Strasbourg.
When we come back from the break, I will tell you about that, the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights in Strasbourg, France, and I'll tell you one more time about the events where Craig will be speaking tonight and tomorrow here in St. Louis. Craig Parton, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd. Pleasure.
And when we come back, we've got open lines for your questions and your comments. Rick Warren was on Larry King Live. He answered a number of questions, some of them very impressed with it, others not so much. I'll get your reaction as well during open lines in the third hour of Issues, Etc. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.